I don't think he needs much of an introduction, because he comes with that whole all for himself. So this is, he knows I'm terrible with pronunciations of names. So Achabe Adeya Sebo is a journalist and a Pan-African activist credited for developing in 1987, the recognition of October as British Black History Month. Born in Ghana, moving out to the United States, where he was active in the Negro History Week, becoming Black History Month, the sense of pride that was found in many African-American children promoted him to draw up a plan during his tenure as Special Projects Coordinator of the Ethnic Minorities Unit in Greater London City. This was to be recognised. The contributions of African, Asian and Caribbean people with other boroughs familiar... I'm not going to read this because I'm going to be all over the place on that. I apologise. Medina, you did a great job putting that together for me, but I have to read that. So, in 1987, Ade developed what we know today as Black History Month in this country, and you're here to tell us a bit about this. Would you like to just give us a little bit of an overview, rather than me waffling through that as I just attempted to do? So it'd probably be better in your own words.
Yeah. I got into this country in 1984, February, under difficult circumstances. A death squad was sent after me by the military regime at that time, led by who later became President Rawlings. With the help of people, I managed to escape, and a police notice was published declaring me a wanted man. So all the security agencies were on a manhunt for me. So for about 3 weeks or so, we were playing hide and seek. People would tell me they are here, go here, hide in this village, this, that. So finally, people helped me to make my way by canoe across the river to the Côte d'Ivoire, that is Ivory Coast. And then from there, I came to the UK as a refugee.
What year was that?
That was in 84. And I came to the UK basically because C.L.R. James was here. And C.L.R. James, I was like his adopted son. So in the US, I was with him. So he had moved to the UK, living in Brixton with the Race Today Collective, Dacus Howe, Linton Kwesi Johnson, and others. So I decided to come here. And also, because there was a large population of Ghanaians in the UK, so that we can continue the struggle to try to get rid of the military dictatorship.
Can I stop you for one moment?
Yeah.
Because you just kind of breezed over that you was with C.R.L. James. How did you meet him?
Oh, we met in the U.S. In the U.S., I ran a radio program called, in Washington, D.C., WPFW. As a part of the Pacifica Radio, which was syndicated across about 25 states. And my radio show was African Roots, American Fruits. And that attracted his attention.
We were having conversations earlier on, and I was mentioning that this is a long history of yes. work that Ade has been putting together. Yeah. So there's always been that that feisty character from a very young age that was a bit of a troublemaker that was just going to shrivel things up, and that's where we come to here.
So Cyril James, of course, knowing that I come from Ghana and knowing. He had researched me, and he invited me over, started talking, and then I started basically looking after him together with a colleague of mine called Zama Cook, and we organized his life in the U.S., and he will proudly tell people that all that Ade knows about politics, I taught him. That's what CLR James will say. So I have been very, very, very privileged. Not only CLR James, but I also sat at the feet, and they instructed me, of Chancellor Williams, the author of The Destruction of Black Civilization, Ben J. Cannon, John Henry Clark, Francis Chris Wilson, and all this. So I have been very, very lucky. And one amazing woman, Mother Africa, called Jewel Mazik, a librarian, historian, researcher, who I'll go to her every morning for about 2 years, about 4 a.m. And she will instruct me till about 7 o'clock. And there was a particular place in her hall. He said, you sit here. This is where Malcolm X used to sit.
Wow.
So that is, so I have been privileged. And so CLR James, there's something I think I have to tell you all that you have to, that was in 1980, April, yeah. He called me at about 5 o'clock in the morning, saying, my son, come, 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 come. So I rushed over to him, and he said, I have to dictate a telegram for you to send it to the WPA, the Working People's Alliance of Guyana. That is Walter Rodney's group. So he dictated a note for me, and basically what the note said was that they should protect Walter. They should protect Walter. What he had heard was that Walter, when they organize meetings like this, he'll be arranging chairs, he'll be doing this. When he's driving in car, he sits in front. He said, no, what is he trying to prove? You are a leader, a political leader, and operating out of Guyana under Burnham, a wicked man, in making him take chances like that. He has to be protected, not be left open like that. So I sent the telegram to Ewusi Koyana and the others. Then 2 weeks later, the news came that Walter had been, his car had been bombed, a parcel bomb or something like that. Yeah, Walter had been killed. And CLR James cried like a baby, because what he suspected had happened. Then he said, Ade, I have to speak to the Pan-African community. I have to speak to them. So Zama Cook and myself, we know that CLR James, even if he is sick, he has to go to hospital. You have to take him to Howard University or to a black doctor. So we have to look for a place. So I went to see the pastor of the AME Zion Church, on 18th Street near DuPont Circle. I explained the circumstances to him and he gave us his church. And within 3 days, we packed the place up, almost getting about 1,500 people. And then he spoke his heart out about the question of power and how you should prepare and all that. And Race Today published that as a pamphlet. So that is the level of my association with C.L.R. James. So running away from persecution and coming here as a refugee, yes, it was in his bosom and the Race Today collective that I sought refuge. And they welcomed me. And fortuitously, I got a job at the Greater London Council.
Okay. So that was really, because there's not a massive gap between you come into the UK and Black History Month,
yes,
the beginning of that. So tell us a bit about that.
Well, I lived in Battersea across the river, not far, very far from the headquarters, the Greater London Council, which was across the river adjacent to Houses of Parliament. And one day I got to work and I saw the secretary to the principal race relations advisor, Anse Wong, Elizabeth, very downcast and almost crying. So I went to her and I said, "Elizabeth, what is the matter?" And Elizabeth said, "Would you believe it? Last night, I was putting Marcus to bed after prayers. As I was leaving the room, Marcus called me back and asked me, 'Mom, why can't I be white?'" She didn't know what to say. So she started, burst out crying. And she said, "I've failed my son. I've failed my son." The son was 6 years old, getting to seven. And Elizabeth had deliberately named the son after Marcus Garvey. And here is the child, worried and disturbed about his identity. So she said, kept saying, "I failed my son." I said, "No, Elizabeth, you haven't failed your son. It is rather the national curriculum. The Inner London Education Authority, the local authorities, the libraries, the churches, and all institutions of state, including us adults, we have failed Marcus, but not only Marcus, but every child growing up in this United Kingdom." So it stirred me up. And for a couple of months, something had to be done. Something had to be done. We had to do something about this. So ideas started coming into my head, jotting them down, and I put a project plan together and went to our unit at the Greater London Council and put it before them. We examined it, challenged it, discussed it, and then we came to the conclusion that we have to organize historical concerts and lectures and exhibitions across London and also spread it out. And the purpose of this was for us to pay tribute and celebrate the contributions of Africa, Africans and people of African descent to world civilization, and particularly the development and growth of this United Kingdom from antiquity to the present. And to ensure that the local authorities discharge their duties according to the appropriate sections of the Race Relations Act of 1976, particularly Section 71, that enjoined the local authorities to ensure that their service provision and delivery serve the purpose of building harmonious race relations. So we had an obligation by law, and the mere fact that acts have been passed by Parliament and Parliament had discussed this and passed a Race Relations Act, and consequently going further to pass the Equal Opportunities Act, show that Parliament itself, the people's representatives, recognized that there was something wrong with British society, and that had to be corrected. So we had the law on our side. We organized these activities, and fortunately, it was well attended. Mr. Lee Robert was part of it. We commissioned him to do a mural.
This is one of the things that I wanted to ask you. Sorry, Robert, not to take the heat off you there. But on that start, when you started, there were some really important people in the room. How did you get all those people into that room at that time? And who were they? Because I don't know if the whole audience will know.
We started with the African Jubilee Year, and we had Winnie Mandela come, Angela Davis, Graca Machel, Sally Mugabe, Jesse Jackson, Ray Charles, Dollar Brand, Max Roach, Ganaba, the Grand Ballet d'African. And we mixed it, and also we included Alap, we included Else in Flight, so we included the Irish, the Asians, and all that, to show that what Marcus Garvey was about, because Marcus Garvey in his long lifetime saw the essence of solidarity, that you cannot struggle alone. So he gave principal support to this struggles of the Irish people and also for the independence of India. So that formed part of our spirit. And the same thing with Nkrumah and his relationship with Bhutto, his relationship with Gandhi, his relationship to Bandaraiki from Sri Lanka, and all. So it was that spirit. And we brought all these people over, Tony Martin, John Henry Clark.
Why was it important to have those people in the room?
Because these people were historical figures who also have struggled within the civil rights movement and across Africa for liberation and all that. So these were significant persons, like Graca Machel, the husband, Samora Machel. The South Africans had brought down his plane and killed him. And she was grieving. And Salim Mugabe called me and said, look, do what you can and get her out and bring her here. So I spoke to Paul Boateng and Ken Livingston and said that this was, and said, okay, we'll bring her. We brought her here and she went in the community, hackney, all over the place, talking to people and all that. And that was a great leap. So we were able to do this because we had an enlightened leadership at the Greater London Council, headed by Ken Livingston. These people were wonderful human beings who cared. They supported the Caribbean Focus. They supported 1984, designated it as a year of anti-racism and anti-apartheid. And so it irritated the Tories, and Margaret Thatcher and Michael Heseltine were determined that they were going to abolish Greater London Council. And they came out with a parliamentary act in 1985. So 86 April, they abolished the Greater London Council. And sold the county hall, the building, to a Japanese entrepreneur to turn it into a hotel, so that you can not come back. It's incredible. I could not believe it, that this is in England, this could happen like that in Britain at that time. But it happened. But under this leadership, we were able to achieve a lot. But we were able to achieve a lot because I managed to get an all-party support for what we were doing. At council meetings, I watched the councillors, saw and studied who was who, whose mind was this and all that, and I'll see someone who opposed or whatever it is. Then one day, all you see, someone knocking at, I'll find where they live. And I'll go knock. Let me sit down with them.
You'll be getting all the quietly over his dead now.
And discuss with them. I said, look, you don't have to oppose it. This is the reason, this is it, that we have legal backing support. We are not going to do anything that will trip you, that will embarrass you, or whatever it is. You see. So the next council meeting, they will support. So that's that quiet diplomacy. And it worked. And more so because maybe I was new. And one said that I did not have any chip on my shoulders or whatever that meant. So that is how we managed to get things through. They voted a lot of money to support what we did, bringing all these artists and intellectuals and civil rights activists and all that from all over the world into London and farming them out across the country and all that. It was an unusual period, but we achieved it. We achieved it. And the result of it is what we see today. I remember I was here in April, briefly, and I went to check my eyes, and at, what do they call it, Pearly Memorial Hospital at Moorfield. And the person who was chatting, an Asian ophthalmologist or ophthalmologist or whatever we call it. She kept looking at the name, and it rang a bell. So she went to her computer. And I said, hey! Hey, she was shouting. She was shouting. I said, ah, this is the founder of Black History Month. Without you, I wouldn't be here. That was wonderful. Without you, I wouldn't even be here. So she went out calling colleagues all over the place. Come. So that is the achievement.
So just to go a little bit back and to go back and forth a little bit. Now, Black History Month in America started, what, 75, I think, was it?
Yeah, that's around 76. Black History Month in America was founded in 1926.
Yes, okay.
By Carter G. Woodson.
Yes, okay.
And he chose February because February was the month in which Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln were born.
But what I wanted to ask, because when especially Americans, and they kind of think about Britain, they're like, oh, well, you haven't got, you know, there isn't an issue for you. They don't understand the struggles that we have here. So, you know, what was it about, I think you may have already answered it, to be honest. I'm saying, what was it about Britain that made it important for this to be happening in this country? Because, you know, when we're looking at it from the American side of things. But I think you've already answered it.
You say that this is what? Babylon. And this is the heart. We will say that the dark continent. But this is the mother of colonialism. The mother of imperialism. And this is important. Mm-hmm. And to me, what worried me most was for a country like United Kingdom to ban Farrakhan from coming here and to ban Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael. This intolerance, or something. Mm. So something had to be done here. Something had to be done here. And we were lucky to have enlightened leadership in Ken Livingston and others. And also at a time when our brothers in America, Sullivan, Jesse Jackson, Andrew Young and all of them were campaigning for boycott of South Africa and the placing of sanctions on South Africa. And here Margaret Thatcher says, hell no, I will not.
So what were your expectations for Black History Month? You know, if you were thinking, you know, at that point, where did you think 30 years on it would be? Is it done what you expected? Would you want more?
Yes. We knew that GLC was going to be abolished. Then the radical boroughs came together, eight of them, to form the London Strategic Policy Unit as a successor body to the GLC. And that also did not last, just for 2 years. And so we had lost a significant backing for the struggles for equality. And but at that time, I had a trust and whatever resources that I could have asked for, Ken Livingston and others would have entrusted me with, because we could account for every single penny that was given to us. There was that kind of discipline. And everything that we did also, we had legal justification for it. We were lucky to have the chambers of Lord Gifford, who is in Jamaica now. So everything that we do, we have to make sure that they combed it, that it fell within the law. So I thought first of establishing a think tank, a clearinghouse, which will direct and govern Black History Month. But then I thought about it and I said, no, it will create a problem. Because it's human beings. Who are you going to put there as the directors on board? They will end up fighting among themselves. So why don't you rather cast the seeds wide and sow it within the communities and let people run with it? And that is what we did. And it has borne fruit. You are an example. And the exhibition that you've mounted is an example. And the fact that we are here, all that is an example of it. So all over the country, individuals who believe in doing something have facilitated in organizing activities. As I'm talking to you now, there may be about 10,000 activities going over all over this country. And so the power is with you, and you have the laws also with you. The Race Relations Act is a powerful act, and the African Jubilee Year Declaration also is a very powerful declaration, which the local authorities in London, the Inner London Education Authority, and these were also sent across the country, which they endorsed it. So they have some obligations which you can challenge them to do something. So I'm very happy with what has happened. Mm. I returned to Ghana about 2010 and stayed for a long time. When I came back, and recently, going about, I see posters, banners, advertising, and I see a lot of my faces. When I turn on the television, I'm seeing my faces on television. So diversity is becoming a reality. And it is reflecting why we also chose October. In October, when you take a ride across the valleys and the hills, and you see the changing of the colors, the leaves of multiple colors, the enchanting array of browns, yellows, black, whites, and all that. That is the richness of diversity. And that is why we also chose October. That is what it represents. And I see this happening now, and I'm happy. And more so, that even in the cities, they're employing people to respond to the issue of diversity. I said, well, what is diversity thing? What is this diversity thing? But it shows improvement. And I also see the faces, demeanors, and the way that our young people are asserting themselves and all that. But sometimes it runs into problems. That's a whole issue that concerns me a lot. With the gun and the knife culture and all this, it troubles me a lot. So I am very, very happy. I'm happy with how far we have come. And when I see people like Robert and others still at it with the young people in schools and teaching and using art forms of communication, and that's what we did. We use art forms, popular culture of communication. And I would like to add this also. After the GLC, I worked with the Notting Hill Carnival as the operations manager. Basically, I was running the carnival from 1989 to 1993. We were working at that time, we were very closely with Clay Holder. And with the experience that I've had at the Greater London Council, and Sir Wong, who was part of the Carnival Committee, invited me to come and help rebrand the Carnival, because Carnival was going through a lot of difficulties and problems. So I went in, and with Claire Holder and Ansel Wong, and I brought in a financial manager, Chris Norte, and we reorganized the carnival with difficulties. I was threatened several times. People will come and spit at me, "You dirty African, keep your hands off our carnival." No. But we took it all in stride, because they didn't know. They don't know themselves. So seeing this development now here, and seeing a lot of young people enterprising, setting up their own businesses here and succeeding, some in the cities and all that, doing marvelously well, and musicians, athletes, sportsmen. We still have problems in football with jingoism and bigotry and racism and all that. We have a lot of work to do there. So I am happy. I'm really, really happy with what we have achieved.
I'm pleased with that, and I think that's brilliant. But I know there's still a troublemaker in there. And we've got a big anniversary coming up pretty soon.
Yeah.
So what are the intentions for that?
Well, 2027, will mark the 40th anniversary of Black History Month. So we have to start planning and fill it with rich content. You hear the complaints that, Black History Month is about food, dances, and all that. It's dampening the spirits of people. It's not true. What is the quality of what we're experiencing here today? What is the quality of the exhibition that you put here today? It's not true. It's the same thing with Black Lives Matter. Then we try to dampen it. White Lives Matter, All Lives Matter. Why? You see, so we don't have to. But The important thing is that Black History Month is yours. It's yours. It's for all of us. And you should hold it as of great value, because you have a whole month in British annual calendar. There's nothing like that. There's nothing like that. This is the only life. So you should hold, it's your space. And it is your responsibility to fill it with rich content. It's not my responsibility. It's not the local authority's responsibility. Why are you attacking the local authorities and the government and others? Who are those there organizing activities that you are not happy with? They are doing it within the remit of what they know. And you may not know the difficulties even that they may face to have even done that. I remember one incident at the British Museum. They had a program with Hugh Masekela. And Hugh invited me. Before he came, he told me he was coming. I went. And it was an excellent program. So I asked Hugh, who invited you? And he told me. So I asked of him. And his office was in a corner in the basement. I went there, knocked, come in. I went and said him, I went and congratulated him. Sat down with him. And he told me the trouble he went through to get that to be funded and to happen. And he was a white man. So we have to be very, very careful. We have to be very, very, very careful. Because we had that debate. Why black? And why are you involving Asians? Why are you involving the Irish? Why are you involving the Turkish and the travelers and all that? And I said, you know what? During African Jubilee year, we had solidarity messages from the Dalit in India, from the Aborigines in Australia, far away in Australia, they heard about, they sent solidarity message to us. We had some, the First Nations, the Native Americans, Eskimos. We had all these solidarity. So they made it possible for what we are. So that is what we represent. But above all, also, as a black person, black absorbs all colors. Black is a font of all colors. And whatever it is also, Africa is the mother of humanity. So you have to be. So you cannot struggle alone. That is the important thing. You cannot look at what is happening. The tribal wars going on in Europe now, with what do we call it?
Russia and Ukraine.
Yes, Ukraine and all these things going, and with solidarity. Everyone is trying to build solidarity and all that. So we need that in our lives. We need that in our lives. And all our enlightened leaders, Nkrumah, his most trusted person, who he entrusted his literary works to, was June Milne, a white lady who was his publisher. And the risks that June Milne took when Nkrumah was overthrown, and when Nkrumah was in Guinea, and again when he died, and later on his house, his books, another personal effects, there was another coup d'etat, and the soldiers went there and ransacked the place and burning things. She took the risk to enter Conakry at that time to go and collect as much material, went about 3 trips and brought the material and to store them here. Some of them at Harvard University. She died almost about 8 years ago, and recently part of it we had to send to South Africa. And so is these rules. So we have to be extremely careful in our relations with one another. What I always say is this: in order to create harmony on the piano or the organ, you need both the black and white keys. But both keys have to be well tuned. But we're in a situation where, because of colonialism, the black key is out of tune. That is why
that's such a beautiful
the Race Relations Act. That is why the Equalities Act. So we all have a responsibility to see that to attain that harmony, we have to tune, get the black key to be in tune. It's our responsibility. That's what I leave you.
Yeah, I see that. I kind of think, you know, remember the conversation we were having earlier where we mentioned that a lot of the, you know, we're always the ones that are brought to, when there is an issue around racism or whatsoever, it's always the expectation that the black community is going to go and fix this. And, you know, we both said, it's not our problem. This is, you know, if there is a problem with racism, it's not the black community, it's the white community. But we're the ones that are brought in to fix this problem. But we can't, because we're not in control of it. It's not our problem. So it's kind of looking at that, a different way of looking at that, which is quite interesting.
Yeah, but it is true. Because as a black person, I did not classify the human race according to skin pigmentation. I did not classify. As some people standing somewhere, your crane, your skin, or whatever it is. And W.E.B. Du Bois, he saw this very clearly and said that the problem of the 20th century is a problem of the color line. And it remains the problem of the third millennium or the 21st century. It still remains, and that is the reality. And we, in our own interests, we also have a lot to do to help tune. Because when I think about Marcus, and I think about the young people growing up here, Some of them now we are struggling with the term Black British, British Black, British. We are struggling with that term. Again, classification, color. I remember somewhere around about 1971, I wrote a poem, I'm African and I'm proud, and basically saying that I'm not a color. I'm not a color. I'm African, I'm not a color. I'm not black. I'm not a color. I do not fade. I'm black. And neither am I a shade. So, we have a responsibility because we are faced with a very serious problem which almost got me killed in 1984, and they came after me. Because we have in Africa imposed on us leaders who are not Africans. They are assimilated. Everything about them is their value systems and all that is like the colonial master. Mm-hmm. It's like you heard about what is going on in Niger now. You've heard about the French and all that. The former president that has been overthrown. He appealed to President Biden to put pressure for him to be released because he and Biden, they share the same values. They share the same values. So that is what we have, the problem that we have. They share the same values to us. They extend that uranium that is sold on the world price at about $235 per kilogram. This former president and his successors, they have been selling it to the French for 83 cents. And this same thing is happening in Ghana. You've heard about this mineral for the making of batteries for the automobile industry. The name will come. Ghana, we found three rich deposits and they have given the rights to an Australian startup company that has no record of history in that. And Ghana is getting less than 10%. So we live in a situation in Africa where today, as I'm speaking to you, you find sections of our population drinking, taking water for food, bath, and everything from a pond that they share with cows, with lizards, with ducks, with pigs, and all that. In 2023, this is real. And when you see this on the television and the strife, and people living, trying to cross the Sahara, come to the Mediterranean, and migrate over, and young people see all this, they get confused and they don't want to relate to. And children can be very wicked at school. They will laugh at you. So they shrink. They are confused because of my terrible leadership. that made Marcus to question his identity because of what he may have faced at school.
Okay.
And the same, that is what it is. So we have a responsibility, particularly the so-called leaders in the Caribbean, in Africa, and all that. It's a mess. I am angry. And that was what almost got me killed. So I've been fighting this for 10 years. Because we have in Africa leaders who have made it possible for Africa to be recolonized. I'll tell you something. In 1979, Der Spiegel, it's a German newspaper magazine, I saw an article in it where the author was saying that the dynamics of the world economy has changed. And the Western world has reshaped the economy in such a way that there's no need now for them to send ships to Africa to find slaves, to go and work in the plantations and others for them. But they have turned the economy in such a way that they have destroyed the economies of Africa so that Africans will voluntarily struggle to come to Europe to come and enslave themselves. That was in 79. And it is happening. We are risking lives, rickety boats to come. That is the real. And why? It's because of the leadership of my generation. That's what hurts me so much. Because the Nkrumah generation, the George Padmore generation, C.L.R. James, those who sat in Manchester in 1945 to plan for the total liberation of Africa. And then we got our independence. And the Nkrumah generation, they did everything for my generation. They sent us to the best universities across the world, Yale, Harvard, Oxford, Cambridge. And we saw how other societies had organized themselves. We went to school. If I was at Temple University in Philadelphia, I went to school not over potholes, filthy gutters, clean environment. So at least I have a mental vision of quality life. Then my generation, we took over power from 1980s up till now. Absolute power, exercise absolute power over life and property, killing people as they were trying to kill me, my own generation, controlling the wealth, the diamonds, the gold, the bauxite, the uraniums, name it, iron, copper. And yet still, look at the state of Africa. And that is my anger. That is my anger. It's very disgraceful. So I'm angry with my generation because we have betrayed the younger generation. And I always say that a society is on the verge of collapse when the vast majority of its youth wake up in the morning with nothing to look forward to. And this is what is happening in Africa, in the Caribbean.
Okay, I've got one last quick question from you, and then I want to open it up to the rest of you to, if you've got any questions. With that in mind, would you, and if so, what would you do differently? Would you have done anything differently? By saying what you've just said, that you feel like it was down to your generation.
Yeah.
Is there a different way that you may have done things previously?
Well, you see, one thing that has... we haven't looked at very carefully is the whole education system. Mm-hmm. And... Bob Marley was right. We have to do something about mental slavery.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And mental slavery is real. Because not much has been done to decolonize our minds. So that is my theme now. We have to decolonize in order to humanize, because colonialism is an act of dehumanization. Because for colonialism to succeed, the indigenous people have to be dehumanized. Their language taken away from them, their culture made to be said not worth anything. That is how colonialism succeeded, by dehumanization. So in order to humanize, we have to decolonize. In order to humanize, we have to decolonize. So decolonization is very, very important, and that has to be done mentally. And that is why we say that the national curriculum, something has to be done. So we have a situation in Ghana presently where the educational system is said that you will have a Ghanaian student going to the university to study political science, economics, history, philosophy, anthropology, and all that. For 4 years, they will come out with a first-class degree, and they would not have studied a single book of Nkrumah. In Ghana, soon after 1966, when Nkrumah was overthrown, Nkrumah's books, writings, effigy were banned, and it was a criminal offense to hold these. So they banned Nkrumah's books. And I recall myself that the U.S. ambassador at that time, Franklin Williams, he went to a school in Accra, Chimota School, and got the students to get all Nkrumah's books, Marx's books, and all that, came out and made a bonfire, and they lit it. That's the U.S. ambassador. And who was it, Franklin Williams? Franklin Williams was a mate of Nkrumah at Lincoln University in Philadelphia.
I always seem to go for the libraries.
You see,
when you look through history.
And this is happening in Ghana. I remember my own incident, because books were Nkrumah's books were banned, and I'm a librarian, and I worked in a library in Ghana,
And one day I was at the stock room under the basement, going around, and I saw some piles of boxes piled at the corner there. And I went and opened it, and I saw books of Nkrumah start there. So I went to the stock room manager, Mrs. Nylander. I said, "What is this?" "Yeah, after 66, some of us piled something and packed them here." So I didn't say anything. I went back to the lending section, then to the reference section, and looked at the index box. Says, and I found the Nkrumah's the in the index cards there. I said, "Oh, that is wonderful." So I quietly started putting some of the books back on the shelves. I didn't quietly move them. And people were checking them out, That was one of my troubles. So this is happening in Ghana and it's happening now. So you can see the problem that we are faced with. The issue of education, it has not been settled to the extent that the regimes in Ghana dropped the study of history as part of the national curriculum. Would you believe it? In Ghana, dropped the study of history. So, and it's being run by my generation. That is my anger. So we are in serious trouble in Africa. Serious trouble. And it is because of this that you see, the spectacle that you see on television, the confusion, the hunger, the strife, people running away of mismanagement and of leaders that are agents of recolonization without responsibility. And Nkrumah explained everything in the book Neocolonialism, The Last Stage of Imperialism. And it was because of that book that he was overthrown. He published that book in 1965, and President Johnson and Harold Wilson told him not to publish that book or face the consequences. And Nkrumah published the book, and he faced the consequences. Mm-hmm. They organized the coup, Harold Wilson and Johnson. Nkrumah was going to Hanoi to mediate the Vietnam War with Ho Chi Minh. Then the CIA, the British intelligence, the Canadian intelligence, the German, the French, the Israeli, the South African intelligence, they all pulled together and organized a coup. But before then, Johnson and Harold Wilson were discussing this. And Harold Wilson suggested that Nkrumah should be taken out or killed at the airport when he was embarking on the plane to leave. And Johnson stepped in and said, "No, Harold, no. What about if we fail? So it's better that he gets out of the country and to be so far away that it will be difficult for him to return." Mm. And that is what they did. In February 24th, 1966, Nkrumah was overthrown. And since then, Ghana and Africa has been a watershed.
Fascinating.